Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey, friends, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. A pleasure to have you join me today. A little shout out to listeners who emailed after yesterday's show, those who appreciated the content, those who had questions, those who had criticisms. I actually am happy to interact on all of those subjects and appreciate your feedback. So you can always email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can text us during the show at 877-933-2484. So what we do here on Connecting Faith is we try to bring the mind of Christ to bear on the headline news of the day, try to equip you to enter into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. So we could be grabbing any starter headline for today. I'm going to grab this one from the Associated Press. A day at the beach turns to panic and tragedy. Married couple die. So that's a pretty striking headline. Here's the lead, and this is from Seabrook, New Hampshire. One moment, Matt Tomaswicki was enjoying a sunny day at the beach with his family, and the next, he was running to the ocean with his paddleboard to try to save the lives of six swimmers caught in a rip current. Listen then to the next sentence. He was among numerous Good Samaritans and others who sprang into action Sunday at New Hampshire's Seabrook Beach. Police and fire rescue were called. One officer shed his uniform and jumped in to help the swimmers to shore, returned later with a surfboard in search for another. Lifeguards at a nearby beach swarmed in on jet skis and a rescue boat. Then there is, of course, the information about how this one young husband and dad, 29-year-old former basketball player for Syracuse University, managed to help two people out of the water. A third person who was unconscious, he was able to pull partially onto the board. That person then, when a wave came by, slipped off the board. And this man let the two tired swimmers who were holding onto his paddleboard take the paddleboard in while he continued to swim, searching for the man who had slipped off of the board. So ultimately, this story concludes with a husband and wife, 49-year-old Michael Cote and 47-year-old Laura Cote of Methuen, Massachusetts, being pulled unconscious from the water, and they perished. Now the story takes a turn, because from this point forward in the story, there are quotes from their pastor, Sean Maher, or Mayer, and others in the church that Michael and Laura were members of in Methuen, Massachusetts. And so these are clearly Christians. Five people were rescued and unscathed. We actually know nothing about those people. The people who we know about are the people who perished, and they were Christians. So when we, as Christians, look at a story like this, What do we bring to bear? How do we talk about a day at the beach that, by the headline, turns to panic and tragedy? Well, let me start by saying that actually we've had a lot of news from the beach lately. Just this week, I have heard references to Omaha Beach. That's not a day at the beach, not in the way that we think of it. We've also read an article about a woman walking her dog on Hilton Head Island, and she ended up being pulled into a lagoon by an 8-foot alligator, and she did not survive that experience. That is not the day at the beach that people think of when they're going to go to Hilton Head. There was news of a woman who treaded water for 10 hours after falling off of a cruise ship in the Adriatic. That is not the day at the beach or the cruise on the ocean that we think about. I'm reminded here of a viral video that we love in our family. And it's "Don't Go to the Shark's House." If you've never seen it, let me just warn you in advance. It's hilarious. Rip currents are to blame for the experience of the people off of the Seabrook Beach in New Hampshire. But I want us to also note the Good Samaritan language in this story. where do we as a culture get Good Samaritan language? Where do we even get the idea or the sense of responsibility for others that we would literally put our own lives at risk in order to jump into what is obviously a rip current, what is carrying people out to sea? And we would leave our own family on the beach and put our own life in harm's way in order to go out there and try to save the lives of others. Friends, this is expressly not survival of the fittest. This is anti-Darwinism. This is the opposite of what Darwin claimed would be true. The whole spirit of a good Samaritan, as accounted for here in this particular story from a beach in New Hampshire, is that we have a sense that life matters, that every life matters, and that we should put our own life at risk in order to save the lives of others. The testimony of the man who risked his life to save others, and what he was thinking about life, their lives, their families. And then, yes, as he swam back in, he says he was thinking about his own family. When the story turns to the information about those who perished, we learn that they are Christians. Now, let me just warn you in advance. I'm about to say something that nobody is ever supposed to say out loud, but it's the truth. And so I'm going to say it. If anybody was going to die, at some level, aren't we glad that those who died were believers in Jesus Christ? Doesn't this take us into the complexity of the redemptive narrative and the way God is actually able to be found in a story of tragedy? I find myself thinking about a day at the beach. And I find myself wanting to not only celebrate how wonderful it is to walk the beaches here on earth, but I find myself, wanting to wonder about what is actually on the shoreline of what is described in Revelation as the Sea of Glass. You know, I don't know if it's an actual sea. I have no idea. But if there's a sea, there's a beach. And the day on the beach in heaven is going to be, by every account, wonderful and never ending in the kind of tragedy that this story ends in. Okay, so that's just a one way to take one story from the headline news and find the redemptive thread and find something in there where you, as a believer, can lift up threads of the story that other people may not be seeing, certainly things to which they might not be paying attention. So let me lift up another story. This one is from Buffalo. This caught my attention because at first glance, it looks like, I'll just read you the headline. Who is the Bible study group shopping for members at Walmart? Now, you can see why I would be drawn to such a story. I'm hoping you would be drawn to such a story as well. I'm also hoping that you would be drawn into this kind of activity in your own community. Who is the Bible study group shopping for members at Walmart? I mean, do you go to Walmart to shop or do you go to Walmart to shop? These are good questions to ask. So here's the lead of this story. And again, it's from the Buffalo News. Samantha Christman is the byline. For months, people have been approaching shoppers at stores across the Buffalo Niagara Market, striking up conversations with them, then inviting them to Bible studies at their church to learn about a holy figure they call God the Mother. Now, I know, now you're all freaked out. Okay, well, just go with me here for a minute. These encounters take place at Wegmans and Walmart, and they have prompted viral social media posts, frightened calls to the police, and wild rumors. If we ask members of the World Mission Society Church of God, they're going to tell us that they're simply devoted members of an Amherst church trying to share their faith in public with others. And these days, they say, stores are where it's most easy to strike up a conversation. So, let me just say that although I find some concerns in what these folks are finding or believe they're finding in the scriptures, I do applaud their efforts to go where people are to share an invitation not only to their church, but an invitation to the study of scripture. So if these people are out there at Walmart and Wegmans and everywhere else in the world inviting people to Bible study, when's the last time you just came right out and invited somebody to Bible study? who you met at a Walmart. When was the last time you actually took the time to meet somebody at Walmart, as opposed to just sort of go in, strategically shop, and get back out as fast as you can? So here is going to be my encouragement today. Take whatever it is that God gives you. Literally, take whatever it is. Take a story about the day at the beach. Take a story about people shopping for Bible study members at Walmart. And use it to your conversational advantage as you are out there in the world that God so loves, as an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdom of this world, bearing authentic witness to who he is and the redemptive narrative of all of human history. You know, that's the assignment that you and I are each on every single day. All right, friends, next up, Dan Darling. Dan is the real deal. He's a Christian, husband, father, pastor, cultural commentator. He's the vice president for communications for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. He's also an author. He's joining me today to talk about the dignity revolution and how each and every one of us can start participating today in changing the world by reclaiming God's rich vision for humanity. This is Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. I'll be right back. Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Sometimes I'm listening and nothing's coming through the headphones. So here we go. I'm back and you're here and I'm thrilled to be with you. Joining me now is Dan Darling. Dan is, among other things, an author. And he has a brand new book out called The Dignity Revolution, Reclaiming God's Rich Vision for Humanity. Dan, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Carmen, it's great to be here with you back on Connecting Faith.
So we love talking with you, and normally we talk with you about like headline news and things going on with the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. But today, let's just hone right in on the subject matter of this new book. And I'd love to just start with the answer to the question of what is dignity and why does it matter?
Well, dignity, human dignity, is essentially the idea that every person worth and dignity and is valuable, that there are no disposable people, there are no throwaway people, that despite someone's giftedness or competence or cognitive ability, they have value and dignity regardless of what we perceive they value they bring. Now, as Christians, I believe that's rooted in the scriptures, this idea that humans are created in the image of God, and that there's something special about the way that God created human beings, different from the rest of the natural world.
So on the back of the book, it says this: imagine if God's people began to lead a new quiet revolution founded on a simple premise. Every human being, no matter who they are, no matter where they are, no matter what they have done or have had done to them, possesses dignity. Don't read this book if you don't want to be challenged. Do read it if you want to join a movement that can change the world, one life, one moment, one act of quiet activism at a time. Do read it if you want to be changed as you see people in the way God sees them. So I buy into this. I'm a person who actually thinks that we change the cultural conversation and therefore the culture by changing every conversation. And that's what you're getting at. You're getting at this moment by moment, every single decision and word and interaction with another human being is ultimately either advancing the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world, or it's buying into the degradation that we experience in the culture oftentimes. So talk with us about why we need this revolution.
Well, we need the revolution, I think, is because the Christians, like the rest of the world, are tempted to sort of view certain groups of people as less than human. We're tempted to be impacted by what's around us based on tribalism, based on any number of factors. But the church is at its best when it actually sees humanity in people that everyone else doesn't. So, you know, for me, I was sort of brought up in the pro-life movement, and it really, I think, has given, introduced into the culture, the moral vocabulary that we need that says, you know, the most vulnerable among us, the unborn, they're not a clump of cells or not fetuses. These are people, humans with heartbeats and DNA and with value and worth. And so I think, imagine if we brought that idea toward other people and really that kind of framed the way we engage the world. And I think the church is at its best when it does that. You know, throughout church history, it's been Christians who have founded hospitals and who have come alongside the most vulnerable. It's Christians like William Wilberforce who helped end the slave trade. But also, at times, it's Christians who have either been silent or complicit when groups of people are being dehumanized. And so I think a robust vision of human dignity based on the Christian gospel is really can really help us lead a revolution.
Okay, friends, if you're listening to this conversation and you're saying to yourself, that's a book that I want and need, I might have more than one copy to give away, but I know I have one copy because I actually have two, and I'm willing to give one of my copies away. So if you want a copy of The Dignity Revolution, you can call or text 877-933-2484, or you can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. It's obviously going to be a drawing because I might only have one, but I might have more. So so I will check in with our friends at the Good Book Company because I might have more than one copy to give away. But Dan, I so appreciate this. I resonate with every part of the book. And I really appreciated that after you sort of help us rediscover in section one what it means to find dignity, you then really lead us to contend for dignity in every arena of life. And I think people are probably really tempted to look ahead to like the very last chapter and jump to the politics section of the book. But I appreciate that you spend time with us talking about race and talking about life and talking about justice and talking about immigration and death and disease and healthcare and work and poverty, identity, the realities of technology in the digital age, and then pluralism. And so if you and I can spend a little time in that chapter, in chapter 11, because I feel like this conversation about learning to agree to disagree on some things is not like ultimately compromising the gospel. And so can you talk with us about this particular conversation in chapter 11 about agreeing to disagree?
Well, I think it was really important because I think sometimes we don't think of religious liberty and human dignity in the same terms, but we really should. I mean, because if you think about what Jesus is saying when he says to the religious leaders, the people who are trying to trap him, he's saying, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. And he asks, you know, whose image is on the coin? What he's saying is that there's certain things that citizens of a republic owe their state because God has granted power to the state for certain things. But he's saying there's certain things that the state has no authority over, and the state does not have authority over the conscience, that we were not created in the image of the state, we're not created in the image of Caesar, we're created in the image of God. And I think this idea of religious liberty says that people are whole human beings, people, so a state that forces them to believe one way or the other is a state that is not recognizing their full humanity. And as Christians, we should work for religious liberty and a kind of a free public square, because we recognize the humanity of our neighbors, even for those religions that we eternally disagree with, that we believe in the power of the gospel so strongly that we don't need the state to put its thumb on the scale to give us an advantage. And because we work for religious liberty, we're working for the liberty of our neighbors, who then we hope will choose to follow Christ. And so I think these two things really, really go together, and you see around the world, places where there is robust religious liberty protections, there then usually follows robust human rights protections. But places where there's not robust religious liberty protections, you see a lot of human rights violations. I think these two things really go together.
So as soon as you start the religious liberty conversation today, as soon as you say those two words, there are absolutely those who, you know, they're I don't know if it's the rises on the back of their neck or not. I don't know if they actually like get a fear response, but they're certainly their pulse starts racing, and they absolutely begin imagining that what you are saying is that that the religious liberty of the individual is going to suppress or discriminate against another person in terms of, let's say, their sexual proclivity. So I think we have to have the conversation about this collision between religious liberty and human rights in our culture today.
I think it is. And I think there's a misunderstanding of what tolerance and religious liberty is. You know, I think when we're talking about religious liberty, it really worries me that now it's being used in scare quotes. It used to be kind of a non-political idea. But I do think we've got this idea that in order to respect someone's full humanity, you have to also affirm every decision they make and every lifestyle they choose. That's not actually what it is to see the dignity of others. In fact, to see the dignity of others is to see their humanity and see them in everything that they are, and to disagree with them at points because they're a free human agent. We also, as Christians, don't believe that our identity is wrapped up in our sexuality and our choices, that we're not the sum total of our desires, but we're created in the image of God. That's where we find our identity. And so I think Christians should continue to work for religious liberty, even though there's somewhat opposition, because we're putting in place protections that not only protect Christians, but also protect other religions. I think we'll eventually come back to people who kind of oppose this. I think when you start to actually break it down, people will realize this is something that's really needed.
So I want to circle back around to that identity conversation that you just started. Walk around in that a little bit for us, because I do think there's profound confusion about what it even means to be human, what it means to be a person, and whether or not I am my avatar.
Well, I mean, I think the culture, people are increasingly asking today, what does it mean to be human? I think we're asking this on a number of levels. One, because the advent of technology and, you know, what it's telling us, or what we're asking ourselves of what it means to be human. But also, I think the discussion about the sexual revolution and the lie of the sexual revolution is that we are autonomous beings and that we know better for ourselves than the creator who created us. That this was the original lie in the Garden of Eden, where, you know, the serpent said to Adam and Eve that if you could be God, you could be your own God if you just do this. And actually, in reaching to be like God, we actually become less than human. To sin is not to be human. It's a distortion of our humanity. And we only find full satisfaction and joy in living and being in tune with the one who created us. And thankfully, we have Christ, who has come in the flesh, fully human, as the second Adam, to do what the first Adam couldn't do. And he restores our humanity, restores us to our image-bearing purposes. So I think this is a really important conversation. You know, Frank Sinatra saying, "I did it my way," which sounds really cool, but how does that work out for people? It doesn't work out well. We see just the effects of it all around us, that this is not the way that God designed us to live.
Absolutely. All right, friends. Hey, when we come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Dan Darling. We're talking about the dignity revolution. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I am joined today by Dan Darling. You can find him at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. You can also, I would really encourage you to check out his new book, The Dignity Revolution, Reclaiming God's Rich Vision for Humanity. Dan, as we were talking about this, it occurs to me that if we're going to talk about humanity and we're going to talk about reclaiming God's vision for humanity, we also have to talk about all of those ways in which we tend to dehumanize one another. So can you till some of that soil for us? What are some of the ways in our culture that we dehumanize one another?
Well, I think there's a variety of ways. I mean, I think on one hand, even some of the rhetoric we're tempted to use, where
if I called you a dog, that would be dehumanizing.
The way that we talk about unborn life, we call unborn babies fetuses or sort of clumps of cells or tissue in a way that kind of lessen their humanity. Or the way that sometimes we talk about immigrants. You know, immigration is a complex topic, and good people have disagreements on exactly how to solve the problem. But when we start to view them as a burden or as, you know, trash or as mules or other ways that they've often been described, I think we're dehumanizing them. And if you look at societies throughout history, any time a group of people has been dehumanized, even in rhetorically or scapegoated that way, it does pave the way toward further harm against them. I also think about the way even in that we have our arguments online, that at times – because a lot of times we're removed from face-to-face conversations, that mediums like Twitter or Facebook, which can be productive and helpful at times, often can take away our humanity, where we think we're sparring just with an avatar, or we're sparring with a set of principles instead of realizing that person on the other side of that argument, the other side of that screen, is a full human being who was created in the image of God. And is worthy of respect and dignity, even as we disagree pretty strongly with them.
So I think that the rhetorical reduction of other human beings to anything that is less than human is actually something that each and every one of us could right now have a pretty serious conversation with ourselves about. You know, like when have I fallen into that rhetorical trap or been tempted to refer to another human being as anything less than human. And I think that there are people who, unfortunately, Dan, they refer to themselves in ways that are less than human. Some of the confusion and brokenness in our culture tends to lead people, it seems, to reduce themselves to something that is less than a fully human, made in the image of God, dignified, redeemed, worthy of, worthy of not just a voice, but worthy of full participation in society. So I think when we start talking about a dignity revolution, we have to sort of at first look at ourselves and our own, the places where we have certainly fallen short in terms of acknowledging and lifting up the full dignity of others. But then we almost have to engage proactively on their behalf, because I feel like if you have been a person who has been robbed of your dignity over time, how are you ever going to find the way or the space or the platform to ever stand up and find a voice?
That's exactly right. You know, understanding fully what it means to be created in the image of God not only helps us understand how to think about our neighbors, but how to think about ourselves. And actually, those two things are linked, because when we think well about ourselves in terms of that I am an image bearer, I was created by God for purpose and to fulfill the purposes of my Creator. I mean, this is essentially what we're telling people in the gospel. When we introduce people to the Christian gospel, we're saying, at the very least, you were created by God in His image, and you've been separated from your father, from your creator, by sin, but Christ has come to reconcile you to your creator and restore you to those purposes. But when we think well, that when we realize that we are not animals, but we're also not God, that helps us to think well about others. Because when we turn away from idolatry and worshiping ourselves as autonomous, you know, gods, then we are free to look around us and say, okay, who are the people who are vulnerable? Who are the people that society is leaving behind? Who are the people in my world that with my voice and my agency and my resources that I can come alongside? But when we're thinking about ourselves and our self-interest, we're not free to do that.
So it occurs to me as you're saying that there is a contest of ideas in our culture in relationship to this very conversation. Because as soon as you say that it's idolatrous, and it is, to consider that we are autonomous and that we are, the makers of our own destiny, and that we are in control of everything. I mean, that's sort of the height of hubris. But I think that when you turn this conversation around, the criticism often of Christians is that we are the ones who think of ourselves more highly than we ought. And what you're saying is, in the dignity revolution, we're actually trying to get people to see the reality that to say that we're image bearers of God and that we're redeemed in Jesus Christ and therefore, you know, worthy of glory ultimately, but it's God's glory, that's actually a really humble thing to say. I think that's just confusing to people who think the way the world thinks about things. But I'm trying to kind of sift through the humility, arrogance, autonomy, image of God conversation here.
Well, you're exactly right. We think that we are good gods. We think that we are good masters of our own fate. But in reality, we're not, because we're not created to be gods. We're not created to be autonomous selves. And we can just look around, and I think people instinctively know this, whether or not you're a Christian, to know how does that work? When you look at someone who has been given the opportunity to live out every single one of their, you know, desires, people usually end up miserable, selfish, not fun to be around with, but also just internally miserable. I think we all instinctively know that we were made for more. We were made for something different, something better. And that's the good news of the gospel, that we were made to live and in tune with our Creator, that He has given us a purpose. He's created us as His image bearers to fill the earth with His glory. Not only that, but He's rescued our humanity. I think we look around and instinctively know that something's wrong. Something's damaged about our humanity. I don't think it takes much to scroll the headlines or just even look in our own lives, our own families, or just in our communities to say something terribly has gone wrong. That's the good news of the gospel, to say that Jesus has come to restore our humanity, to reconcile us to our Creator, and to restore what sin has destroyed in the cosmos and the planet. And then He's renewing and restoring the world, and one day He'll usher in the full and final kingdom.
So, friends, my conversation partner is Dan Darling. You can follow him on Twitter at Dan Darling. We're talking about the Dignity Revolution. If you are interested in a copy of the book, you can text me at 877-933-2484, or you can email me, Carmen, at myfaithradio.com. So, Dan, I would love to change gears just slightly, because this particular book has given you the opportunity to say some things in some places and to some audiences that might surprise some people. I'm thinking that MSNBC is not primarily the platform on which Christians get to talk quite this openly about the Christian view of reality and the Christian view of humanity and dignity and all of the conversations that you lift up in this book. So as a communications professional, talk with us about the experience of being a public Christian today.
That's a great point. I think, you're exactly right. I think a lot of the Christian message is sort of seems strange to people who are not familiar with it or even antagonistic to it. And I think one of the things Christians have to do, I think our tendency is to kind of soften the edges of the strangeness of the gospel. But actually, I think we need to lean into that. But do that in a consistent way. So I think a lot of times you have people who are thankfully really passionately pro-life, for instance, on one side, and really see the dignity of the unborn. You have people on this other side who are passionately for justice. They're passionately for the impoverished and the poor. And I think the Bible comes in and says we should be both. And I think when you have a consistent message of human dignity, that every person is created in the image of God and has worth and dignity, there's going to be points at where, you know, a more liberal audience like MSNBC is going to flinch when you're talking about pro-life issues, when you're talking about the sexual revolution. But then they're also going to it's also going to kind of reach what Charles Taylor calls the thin places, where they know instinctively that there's ways that humans are being dehumanized, and they just don't have the moral vocabulary to understand why. And I think we can press the gospel into that in a way that is inviting them to interact with the whole gospel story.
So, of all of the conversations that you've already had in relationship to this book, what has surprised you most about people's reaction?
I think one of the things that surprises me is just how much people are kind of hungry for kind of a fresh way, particularly Christians, a fresh way for engaging the culture. It's interesting. This is considered a fresh new approach, but actually, even I say this in my title, that we're just reclaiming this robust vision of human dignity that we've already had. We're returning to the old past, if you will. But I think people are really hungry for this. I think they see sort of left and right battling back and forth. I think they see, you know, people who are sort of, you know, we're kind of tribalized. We are sorted into our tribes, and we don't interact with other tribes. We don't see people in other tribes as being fully human. And I think people are exhausted by that in some ways and wanting kind of a fresh way of seeing the world.
So, friends, the book is The Dignity Revolution. The author is Dan Darling. You can follow Dan. He's actually a really fun follow on Twitter, particularly if you are a Chicago Cubs fan, at Dan Darling. The book is The Dignity Revolution, Reclaiming God's Rich Vision for Humanity. One of your other roles and responsibilities is at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. So that's the ERLC. Tell folks what's happening this fall with the big conference that's taking place in Texas, because I know that if folks want to go, time is getting short to register for that. So can we do a little bit of a shout out for that event, Dan?
Absolutely. So we're really excited. We're gathering some of the best minds, pastors, educators, leaders to come together in Texas in October to think through what does it mean for families to live on mission for God in this world. And I think when you think of family, we're thinking parenting, obviously, because people are really, parents are increasingly asking us, how do I parent kids in this culture? How do I talk to my kids about these difficult issues? But I think it's even broader than that. There are a lot of people concerned about what is happening with the family. Or if you're a pastor or a church leader, you're thinking, how do I minister to the kind of brokenness in families that we see all around us? I don't think you have to be a Christian to see that there's just a lot of kind of brokenness. And so we're very excited about this. Russell Moore, who's our president, has a new book out called The Storm-Tossed Family, where he really goes deep and says, okay, what does the brokenness our families teach us about God? How can we invite people to become part of the larger family of God? And so if you're at all interested, you can do this, register online at erlc.com/events. Russell Moore will be speaking, Jen Wilkin, Ray Ortland, Eric Mason, Beth Moore, Matt Chandler, and several others will be there. I encourage you to come with your church group, to come with your leaders, invite some key families in your church and come and really learn and spend time fellowshipping and really, I think, coming away with just a heart and a desire to reach the families in your community.
I can also just say that in my experience in the past, one of the great benefits of going to an ERLC conference are simply the relationships with other people who are attending that you get to meet and spend time with. It is so just let me encourage you. Obviously, the content is going to be great. It's October 11 to 13 in Dallas, Texas. And you go to erlc.com/events, or actually you can just click on the event button and this is what pops up. Right now, hey, leading the ERLC website, Dan, is actually information about your book, The Dignity Revolution. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. And I encourage people, if you want to get the book, to go to Amazon or Lifeway or Good Book Company or anywhere books are sold.
Absolutely. Hey, thank you, my friend, so much. Let us just be of encouragement to you as you continue to have opportunity to lift up this message in the wider culture. We recognize the challenge that people of Christian conviction increasingly face in the culture. And we thank you for being a person who is helping each and every one of us to communicate the goodness and the beauty and the truth of the gospel in ways that actually honor Jesus. So thank you for your help in equipping us today.
Thank you, Carmen. It's a pleasure to be here talking with you.
Hey, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we're going to be making the connecting point. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Welcome back. Indeed, all my hope is in Jesus, which is a good thing because the world is, it's kind of a mess, and you know that already. So, but I want to interact with a news item today here in the Connecting Point section of the show. And I want to interact with this particular news item because, first of all, it's so troubling. And second of all, I think we have a really redemptive opportunity here in terms of the conversations of the day. So I'm always interested in sort of what's the conversational apologist approach to this? How do I get God back into this conversation? I will read the lead of this article. The title is NARAL, which, by the way, is an abortion advocacy organization. NARAL offers abortion-themed ice cream. Now, just on the face of it, the title is clickbait for sure, for me. Maybe not clickbait for you, but I obviously clicked on it, and I found out about this Rocky Roe versus Wade ice cream. Roe v. Wade, you know, is the case in which the Supreme Court decided to legalize abortion in all 50 states, to recognize it as a right in all in America. And so this is Rocky Roe versus Wade ice cream designed to support abortion. So here is the Facebook page post from NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon. Is the hot weather and political climate getting you down? It's time to eat more ice cream. And so even as we grieve at the just sort of recognizing that we've reached this point where people can joke about the taking of human life of the preborn and turn it into a summer celebration of ice cream fun, buying it by the pint to support the defense of the Roe v. Wade decision. They're calling it Saving Roe from President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. That is actually the effort underway here. By the way, I'm going to be talking tomorrow on Connecting Faith with Ken Starr about Brett Kavanaugh. Ken Starr knows him well. They have worked together for years. And so it'll be fun to hear Ken Starr's personal reflections about Brett Kavanaugh here tomorrow on Connecting Faith. Okay, so here's the from the article. It says this: a Portland-based ice cream shop partnered with NARAL to create a controversial abortion-inspired ice cream flavor to save Roe from President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. For a limited time, What's the Scoop customers can order a pint of Rocky Roe versus Wade for $9.50 to help defend reproductive freedom, according to the NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon fundraiser page and poster. So what do we as Christians say about such things? Obviously, you know, just reflecting back on the conversation we just had with Dan Darling about the dignity revolution and the dignity of every human being, certainly the dignity of preborn human beings, not just those who are who made it to life or made it to this part of life, but actually those who are being knit together even now in their mother's wombs by God, right? He's the one who is fearfully and wonderfully making them, even now. So what are we to say about these things in response to this dehumanization of little people, and also this trivialization of abortion? Because I think that's another part of this in terms of not only the rhetoric, but the fundraising fun that these folks are having literally at the expense of other people's lives. So to answer, I would turn not only to the Word of God, but to the wonder of God's amazing and redemptive grace, and begin to ask ourselves, okay, if NARAL is partnering with an ice cream store to advance its cause, partnering obviously with Facebook as the platform to advertise this, let me ask myself, like, with whom am I actively partnering to create spirit-inspired messages that actually help other people taste and see that the Lord is good? Obviously, I'm not going to develop an abortion-themed ice cream, but what am I going to develop? The Spirit of God is ultimately a creative spirit. And so get your creative juices flowing out there in the culture, and find ways to partner with other spiritually minded people to actually create some messaging that helps other people to taste and see that the Lord is good. I know you can do it. I believe in you. I believe that there are some creative people out there who can figure out how to mix it up in the culture in such a way that other people would actually taste and see that the Lord is good. It's our hope. That's our goal. That's why we're sent out there as ambassadors into the world that God so loves. So here's the second question. Because obviously NARAL and this Pro-Choice Oregon group was able to create some urgency, right? This is a limited time offer. Oh, by the way, the taste and see that the Lord is good, that actually comes from Psalm 34. If you're not familiar with that verse, Blessed are those who take refuge in the Lord. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed are those who take refuge in him. So Psalm 34:8 is my taste and see ice cream passage of the day here at the end of the summer. We're not going to have Rocky Road v. Wade, but what are we going to have? Like, what is the, not just the Christian answer to this particular question, but the Christian answer to this conversation in the culture? You know, let's, again, find some creative ways to help other people taste and see that the Lord is good. And then this sort of second question about creating a sense of urgency. Certainly in their advertising, they, you know, they're saying there's this limited time offer that you can order a pint of this themed ice cream. So when we think about the limited time offer that is actually available, we're talking about advancing the gospel right now with a level of urgency, not because summer's coming to a close, but for individuals and for all, you know, for each of us and for all of us. I mean, things, time, life, it's coming to a close at some point. I don't know exactly when, but I know that it will and that it shall. Just this week here in my own community, tragically, I mean, a young pastor who is just literally like the picture of health and life, you know, told his wife, "Hey, I'm just, you know, feeling like I got a little bit of heartburn." And I went to sit down in a chair in the living room and he dozed off. So she thought, well, you know, he's got a little acid reflux. And so I'm just going to let him sleep right there in that comfy chair. And when she got up in the morning, he had long since, passed from this life to the life that is to come. Life is a gift and a blessing, and every day is precious and every breath is precious, and the gospel is urgent. There's a limited time offer going on here, and you and I are supposed to be the people out there advocating for the gospel always and in all ways. And then, you know, it occurs to me that not only do these people have a Facebook page, but they've got posters all over town. And so if I put messaging on a poster that was related to, let's say, a defense of freedom, how might I creatively capture and communicate the freedom which really sets men free? Like, I don't have an answer to that question, but I'm guessing that there's a graphic designer out there who's like, I know how to do that. I've got an image in mind. I can see that. And that's what the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, by the way, does in the life of a believer. And so let me encourage you today to use the marketplace and the marketplace of ideas to get the good idea of the gospel out there into the mix. Summer is rapidly coming to an end, and so maybe is the time for homemade ice cream. So what might God churn up if some of us actually gave ourselves to the creative calling of serving up the word of God in ways that people actually want to taste and then devour it? Where they want more. Like, so I'm reminded here of the prophet Jeremiah, who took and devoured the word of God and it became his delight, Jeremiah 15:16. I'm reminded of the periodic concern about the lack of food for crowds that were gathered on hillsides when Jesus sent his two disciples to prepare the Passover meal, or the way in which the resurrected Christ was made known to the two guys who we think of as on the road to Emmaus. Christ was literally made known to them in the breaking of the bread. Think about that for a moment. How might God use the fellowship over ice cream or over broken bread to actually reveal the reality of Christ to others? Do you remember the encounter that Jesus had with the woman at the well in John chapter 4? He sent his disciples into town to buy food. And when they came back, he said, you know what? I'm not really hungry. Well, why was that? He said, I've got food you don't know about. Well, what kind of food is that? Well, my food is to do the will of the Father who sent me to accomplish his work. If you and I are feasting on the word of God and we are feasting on the will of God, then we're going to be more prepared to till the cultural soil of our day and actually invite people to taste and see that the Lord is good. That's the offer of the day. Get out there and let's share it with other people. Friends, that's all the time we've got here today on Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith.
Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.